Coming up,
do animals think? Are animals conscious?
If a lion could speak, could we understand it?
The first thing to point out about your question is the presupposition that we let people know what we're thinking or how we're feeling by talking.
Isn't it just a prejudice that makes us think that we have superior minds to pigs, dolphins, chimpanzees, or bears?
A lot of what we know about what people are thinking and feeling is by looking at them and seeing their facial expressions and inferring from their behavior. Animals can do much the same.
Our guest is Colin Allen from Indiana University.
If we want to treat this as a scientific question, which I think it can be, then we need to get into very specific things that specific animals can do.
Big attraction everywhere will be Simon Smith and his dancing bear. Yes, Simon Smith and the amazing dancing bear.
Animal Minds, coming up on Philosophy Talk
after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and also our podcast. We've just finalized an agreement, and we'll have tons of podcasts up for you soon, folks.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad to hear that. Ken, today we're going to talk about animal minds. Now, that's an interesting question. I think my dog has a mind. I think lots of animals have minds, but how do I know that?
Let me ask you a question. Do you know any dog owner who doesn't think that his or her dog has a mind?
Well, that's a very good question. And you know, people think a lot of things. We treat a lot of things as if they have minds that don't. So the question is, how do we know? So let's start with this question. How do I know that you have a mind?
Well, I'm a complicated creature. I've got to tell you that. I engage in complicated behavior. How do I know that you have a mind? You are a complicated creature. You engage in complicated behavior. You talk. You behave in all kinds of ways that it would be impossible for me to explain on any other hypothesis than the hypothesis that you have a mind.
Well, it would be impossible for you to explain, as long as you're assuming that, you know, if you open my head, you wouldn't see a bunch of transistors, but you'd see the kind of gray oatmeal that you have in your head. So since dogs and other mammals are kind of on the same evolutionary tree as us, it seems plausible that if we interpret their behavior along the same lines we would attribute to them a mind. But we have to be careful, because we attribute minds to lots of things, to computers that just kind of pretend to be talking to us. And I've heard you talk to your car.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I used to live in Vermont, and you know, the winters would be really cold. They're really cold. And I remember telling my students one morning, my car just wouldn't start. And I thought, well, I don't blame you, gal. I don't blame you, poor thing. I didn't want to get out of bed this morning. I see how cold it is. You see how cold it is, and you don't want to get out of this cozy garage. I know. That's why you don't want to go. So I attributed beliefs and desires and intentions to my car. And it seemed easy. It fit with its behavior.
So to recap, we have this general problem about other minds of any kind. Since we don't really occupy the other person's head, how do we know that they have a mind? But we seem very confident in the case of persons. Now, how do we extend that to animals, and why don't we want to extend it to computers, at least to the kind we have today? Well, presumably we bring in evolutionary similarities.
Well, one of my teachers at the University of Chicago, a famous philosopher named Donald Davidson, argued that, you know, thought goes where talk goes. Animals don't talk, so they don't think. I mean, humans talk, and that's why we know that they think. But animals, it's not the same.
Well, philosophers have worried about parrots for years. Even John Locke thought there were talking parrots. What do you think?
Well, I don't know what I think, but our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, looked into the mind of one remarkable parrot. She files this report.
Alex is an African gray parrot. His name is actually short for Avian Learning Experiment. His owner, Dr. Irene Pepperberg, has been tutoring him for more than 2 decades, and the results are amazing.
Alex can identify objects referentially, so he can look at an object and tell you things about it, its color, its shape, its material.
For example, a researcher gives Alex a rock and asks him what it is.
What is it?
Rock.
Good boy.
Next, the researcher gives Alex a nail.
Alex, what toy?
Nail,
that's right, you're a good birdie.
But it's more than just identifying an object
He has concepts of bigger and smaller, of same and different. He has comprehension, so he can look at a tray of a number of different objects and tell you which of these objects is green or which is three-corner or which is green and three-corner. He has a concept of absence, numerical concepts, and these are very actually advanced types of concepts because it requires that he processes a lot of information in order to answer our questions.
Pepperberg shows Alex two toy keys, a big one that's red and a small one that's green.
What toy? Can you say better? That's right. Can you tell me how many? How many?
Two.
Very good. Can you tell me what's different? What's different?
Color.
Very good. Different color. And can you tell me what color's smaller? What color's smaller?
Green.
Green. You could have said that a little better. But that's a good boy.
Pepperberg says there's no way Alex is simply memorizing the right answers because she asks him lots of different questions about the same two objects.
So unless he can listen to my question and understand the meaning of each of those questions, he couldn't possibly respond to them appropriately. I believe that he is thinking. I'm not sure he's thinking exactly the same way that humans think. So I don't really like to use the term. I just like to say that he's processing a lot of information. And he's processing it in ways that are similar to, but not identical to, the way humans do.
Alex may be thinking, but that's not necessarily the same as being self-aware.
I really don't get into consciousness other than perceptual consciousness. I mean, obviously he perceives a lot of what's going on and he's aware of what he's perceiving or he couldn't answer the questions. But whether he is aware of being aware, the hallmark of whatever order of consciousness you want to call it, I can't prove that.
Pepperberg says her research shows the way animals think is not as different from the way humans think as we once believed.
We used to start out saying, oh, well, you know, animals don't use tools, and now we have all this data on tool use. And, oh, animals, you know, don't plan for the future. Well, paper just came out last week about some behavior that really does look like literally planning for the future. You know, animals can't use labels referentially. Well, you know, we've got all these things. It's not to the same extent that you and I do it, but it's there in some level.
A study recently published in the journal Nature showed scrub jays can plan for tomorrow without reference to how they feel today. Irene Pepperberg says the similarities between animals and humans have ethical implications.
I mean, I think that there's a really big issue when we start looking at animals and realizing how smart they are and realizing our relationship to them and how we use them in a lot of ways. And, I mean, I certainly would not, you know, eat parrot. But I live in Boston. I'm not going to give up my sheepskin boots and my down jackets.
Meanwhile, Alex continues to learn new concepts. His most recent lessons have dealt with the idea of zero and equating written numbers with the quantities they represent. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Colin Allen. He's professor of history and philosophy of science at the Center for the Integrative Study of Animal Behavior at Indiana University. He's co-editor of The Cognitive Animal and Philosophy Across the Life Sciences. Colin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much for having me, Ken.
Hi, Colin. John Perry here. Say, did you bring your dog into the studio with you?
No, my dog will bolt given any chance, and I didn't think I'd be able to keep her on the leash.
Okay, well, then I'll ask you this question. People can let each other know what they're thinking by talking, but most animals are, you know, Alex to the contrary, can't talk. So how do we know anything at all about what's going on in their alleged minds?
Well, I think the first thing to point out about your question is the presupposition that we let people know what we're thinking or how we're feeling by talking. Yes, we can do that, and you use the word can, but in fact, a lot of what we know about what people are thinking and feeling is by looking at them and seeing their facial expressions and inferring from their behavior. And well, so I think that animals can do much the same.
You're right. I mean, there's all kinds of intelligent behavior besides talking, but a lot of philosophers, like I said, my teacher Donald Davidson has this article, Thought and Talk, that where there's no talk, there's no thought. You think that's just a crazy argument?
Well, it's a highly sophisticated argument. It relies a lot on an idea about what is involved in having a thought at all, and it relies on a premise that in order to have a belief, you've got to have the concept of belief, which I think Davison actually doesn't do a very good job of defending, although it would take us a long time to get into
that.
Yeah,
I don't want to get it. But so you reject that argument.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I mean, Descartes had an argument something like that, and that's kind of the main philosophical objection to the thought that animals have minds, that they don't do this language-like stuff that we do.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that we do talk so much, and philosophers tend to be talkers. You know, look at the name of your show, for instance. we end up thinking that that's all there is to what's going on in our minds cognitively, and we're a self-selected bunch as philosophers, so we tend to gravitate towards words.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the right reply to Davidson was to buy him a dog. But I'm a dog owner, and I don't think I'm too wacko about attributing things to the dog. But here's the way I look at it. It's pretty clear that Gretchen processes information. She picks up information through perception and takes actions that depend on that information and that achieve what are presumably her goals, to eat and drink and stuff. It seems to me that she has some kind of memory because she buries bones in the yard and she goes back and finds the bones. Now, maybe she doesn't. Maybe she's just in the habit of digging for bones where dogs are likely to bury them. She doesn't seem to have much of an attention span, and I doubt very much if she engages in the kind of thinking I do, which really does involve language. So I would distinguish between having beliefs, desires, wants, needs, perception, processing information. I think she does all of those, and I'm sure that she has images float through her mind, but I doubt very much that she has anything like we call thought, this kind of integrative thing that involves sentences, images, and so forth. Now, what do you think about all that?
But wait a minute, Colin and John, I wanted to know right now, though, how are we supposed to go about deciding this? I think we're going to dig into the details in a little bit about, you know, what animals can do, but how are we supposed to go about deciding this other than just anthropomorphizing? I mean, how are we supposed to go about deciding this?
Well, so I think that the tendency of philosophers is to want some very general criterion. You know, we want some one thing that we can latch onto. And my own orientation to this is we really can't avoid the details, that if we want to treat this as a scientific question, which I think it can be, then we need to get into the very specific things that specific animals can do. And so John's long list there of things that he thinks his dog could do is very interesting, things like memory, things like attention, and it's particularly striking, for instance, that a lot of the very exciting work coming out right now, some of which was referred to in your piece about Alex, involves testing the memory specifically of birds, scrub jays, who rely on memory a lot for caching their seeds, for hiding them. And it's provable that they don't just go back and dig up where they might have buried stuff in the past. Squirrels maybe do something like this, but these birds have very specific memories, not just for where they buried stuff, but what they buried and how long ago they buried it, and even who was watching them when they buried it.
Can you explain some of that to us in a way that makes it vivid to our listeners?
Yeah, so briefly. This is some really exciting work by Nikki Clayton in the UK, and she's shown that if you take scrub jays and allow them to bury two different kinds of food, either grubs, which deteriorate over time, or seeds, which don't, and then let them back, they would prefer to eat grubs. But if you wait long enough before letting them back, they will actually go dig for the places where they buried the seeds, not the grubs. So that shows they remembered what and how long ago they buried it. And it turns out also that when they are being watched by another bird, if they bury something and then are allowed back into the same area, under certain conditions, they will rebury the food themselves. And that condition is they have to have had experience of their own stealing food from others.
Right.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're making me think. They think, oh, that guy's been watching me. I don't want him to get my food. I'm going to go move it. I mean, is that?
Yeah, I don't think they have that English sentence running through their head, but they're certainly very aware in some sort of imagistic way about the potential threats. I would tend to put this much more perhaps at a level of feeling rather than articulated sentences.
Yeah, we'll take that up in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is animal minds. Our guest is Colin Allen from Indiana University.
We've been discussing the methods scientists and philosophers use for investigating the minds of animals. Next, we'll delve deeper into the details of animal thought, consciousness, and emotion. You can join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9000. 9917.
I know there are lots of animal lovers out there, admirers of animal minds. Call in and give us your thought. Probing the Animal Mind, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
This is Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is animal minds, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Can your pet really think? Is it conscious of itself? Does it feel love and joy? And what makes you so sure of that?
Give us your opinion. The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And you can email us from anywhere in the world at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Colin Allen from the Center of Integrative Study for Animal Behavior at Indiana University.
So, Colin, look, I want to dig into the details a little bit in this segment. Let's take the last example you gave us. You said something that intrigued me just before we went to the break. You said, well, I don't think the animal, what kind of animal was it?
Scrub jays.
Scrub jays.
Scrub jays, right. I don't think these scrub jays have that English sentence, that stream of thought that I went through. Oh, he saw me, I better hide this. You said there's something else going on. I mean, what supports any hypothesis about that? I mean, why? Are you just making that up? Is there a reason to think it works like this rather than that?
Well, the bird case is really interesting because what we're finding out about their cognition is really remarkable, but we really don't know all that much about their brains. But if we jump back to mammals, we can begin to map out how similar areas are operating in the mammalian brain generally, as what's going on with us. I mean, without the language centers processing specifically sentences, you still have in the primate brain, in the monkey brain, for instance, areas that are concerned with planning actions and so on, that are what our language areas evolved out of. And I tend to think that our language is just another action. It's just something else that we do in response to all of these complicated factors that underlie that behavior.
So
it's more the icing on the cake.
So, Colin, if we look at mammals and if we look at scrub jays, which I guess don't talk like parrots, you said you're pretty sure images are floating through their mind. Now, are there studies about like the areas of the brain that are involved when dogs seem to be dreaming and how those compare to the areas in our brain that are involved when we're dreaming?
Yeah, I don't know of any specific studies that have been done yet, but I do know that there's a group in Budapest that's actually working to get dogs into fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging machines, and they're hoping to pursue some of those questions. A lot have been done on monkeys. And again, I don't follow the dreaming literature particularly closely. I like to just keep to my own dreams, I suppose. One area that's been very interesting in the recent research on monkeys has been looking at these so-called mirror neurons. These mm-hmm. are neurons that are active both when an animal is about to do or doing something and when it sees another doing roughly that same thing. So the very same brain areas are active in both cases. There are lots of interesting details about this, but the basic idea is that there's not much difference between what's going on in the human and what's going on in the monkey in these cases.
When you say not much difference, at what level do you mean that? So I read a piece of yours talking about this is F5. Mirror neurons, kind of, is that?
And that's right. Yeah, F5 refers to an area in the brain.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And you said, and as I recall, I mean, so one of the things that human beings can do is read the minds of other human beings. That is, I can make a guess of what John's likely to do next, right? And it's not just a guess; it's kind of a hypothesis about what he's likely to do next, because I can suss out his beliefs and desires and see what he's perceiving. And human beings are really, really, really good at that. Right.
We are really good at that. But here's something that should give you pause. Some recent work that's going on again in the UK by a neuropsychologist named Ian Apperley shows that, in fact, people don't engage that explicit language reasoning system unless they're pushed to do so. Yet they're perfectly good at making the predictions. So basically the idea is you show somebody a video of something like a crime scene. And in the middle of this crime scene is an incident where somebody is going to go in the wrong place because they don't know that something's been moved. This is what psychologists call the classic false belief task. And if you get to the end and ask people, why did that person go a certain way? They'll give you an answer, and they'll spin it out in terms of beliefs. But if you stop people in the middle and just ask them, where will that person look for such and such? So don't ask in terms of beliefs. Just ask in terms of predicting their behavior. They'll give you a response that at the end, if they've been stopped and given that question, at the end when they're asked what do they believe, they're slow to pull that up, just as slow as somebody who hasn't been asked at all. Whereas you stop in the middle and you ask the belief question, what does this person believe? Then that belief question gets answered much more quickly at the end.
So wait a minute. That's a complicated stuff you just gave us, and I just want to disentangle it just a little bit, right? Okay, so it sounds like you're saying, see if I've got you right. There's kind of two, I don't know, I'm just going to call it two systems operating in the human being, right? There's this high-level reasoning that we can engage in when called upon to do it for some reason. And then there's kind of the online processing that we do to recognize people's, what they're likely to do and all that. And I think the claim is that monkeys maybe have something like that online processing system that we have, even if they don't have that kind of higher order reflective system that we only call on when we really need it. Is that kind of what you were suggesting?
That's basically right. And then the other angle on this is that what you're calling this higher system, this higher processing system, may in fact only come online as a result of certain kinds of experiences, as a certain kind of developmental experience. So when you get to somebody like Alex the parrot, who can answer all these questions, that's not something parrots can normally do. But okay. Alex, as Irene Pepperberg has shown, can be extensively schooled to do this, right? And the same thing for many of the ape studies. If you really school the animal, you can get it to engage in what looks like this higher kind of reasoning. So, but we have that schooling right from the very beginning.
So Connor, it looks to me like there's kind of at least three levels involved. I mean, an animal goes around and he knows what's going on around him. Then there's some animals, humans included, maybe dogs, that seem aware that other things have minds. And, you know, I guess dogs are very good at going from our eye movements to what we're going to do next. Mm-hmm. And then there's this idea of knowing that you are one of those things that you're seeing. You're just one thing among many, and that humans have that. Now, when monkeys look at themselves in the mirror and know that they have a spot on their head, is that really evidence that they have that full-blooded idea that they're just one monkey among others in the world that they can get information about in the same way they get about other monkeys?
Well, the first thing is to say that actually nobody's convincingly shown that monkeys can do that at all. We have some evidence. Most people believe that chimpanzees are capable of it. A recent study on an elephant that could do it, and some disputed studies about dolphins, and then some also disputed studies about orangutans and gorillas. So great apes and maybe a couple of other fairly sophisticated, not closely related mammals there. Now, what can you infer from that? Again, I think that it's, you know, you don't want to infer English sentences going through the head of the animal. But does the animal make distinctions between itself and other? At some level, clearly, yes. Yeah. Right? The animal doesn't do certain things with respect to that mirror image that it might do to another if it thought it was another animal. So classically, if you just put a baboon in front of a mirror, you'll get a lot of aggressive interactions.
Colin, yeah, we'll explore that some more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is animal minds. We'd like you to join our discussion, 1-800-525-9917. And Deborah in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Deborah.
Thank you. How are you?
Okay. What's your comment or question?
Well, my comment is I had a Bernese Mountain Dog, and I think most people think their dogs are fabulous, but I would introduce toys to my dog, and I would tell him the name of the toy. For example, one toy, a stuffed animal, was a monkey, and the other stuffed animal was a teddy bear. And once he understood which was which, I could say to him, go get the monkey. He would never get the teddy bear. And yeah. These were animals, similar color, different shapes, because one had longer arms and different tail. But he knew the difference between the monkey and the teddy bear. He knew the difference what the squeaky toy was. I'd say, get the squeaky toy. He'd get the squeaky toy. He would never get the monkey. I'd say, get a shoe. He'd get a shoe. So, I mean, they do learn language.
I think this is great, and it actually taps into a study that was in Science magazine a couple of years ago about a dog in Germany that had something like 200 of these words.
Yeah, I think.
And even more remarkable was that if you showed the dog a set of, let's say, five objects, four of which it knew the words for, and then used a new word, it would go get the fifth object.
Yeah.
And if you came back 2 weeks later with no other training and used that same word, it would know which object to go and get.
Yeah.
And this is...
Colin, Deborah, thanks. Colin, I want to follow up on this for a second, because there's this amazing work by Tomasello about dogs as compared to chimps. I mean, dogs, according to Tomasello, have kind of been bred to understand human communicative intentions. You put a bowl of food behind some barrier where the chimp can't see it, and you have a human being standing there pointing at the bowl of food, and the chimp is like clueless, has no idea. Put a bowl of food behind the barrier and have a dog standing there watching the human point, and the dog will go around there to get the food, right? So it's like dogs are bred to communicate with us, if Tomasello's right.
Yeah, but I really want to push again this developmental line. So the chimps that have failed in those kinds of tests are chimps that have not had the same kinds of experiences as your average family dog had. And the experiments that they're talking about are done with average family dogs. And yes, it's true, we have selected dogs for their responsiveness to us, and that's a huge part of what dogs are capable of. And some very interesting studies are going on comparing dogs and wolves as well in this respect. But there are chimpanzees that one could interact with much more intensively and would be much more likely, I would say, to be able to solve that task. And this is partly shown actually out of Tomasello's own group, where if you put two chimpanzees in a situation which they are used to, where they're competing with each other for some food, and one of them is subordinate to the other, the subordinate seems to know full well what the dominant animal can or cannot see. It will go for food that it judges the dominant cannot see in preference to food that they can both see. So I would say there's something just artificial about the situation in which they were shown to fail.
Oh, okay, Colin. Now, folks, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We've been talking a lot about dogs. We need to give cats their innings. Now, I've got, as well as my dog Gretchen, two cats, a friendly one named Macintosh and an unfriendly one named Microsoft. And I have to admit, I do not think Macintosh and Microsoft are nearly as bright as Gretchen. But we have some people that disagree with us. This is from Sarah, and she says, "My cat Missy definitely talks to me. She tells me what she wants by walking over to me, putting her paw in my lap, and meowing. I know exactly what this means. Well, I couldn't tell you exactly, but if I proceed to play with her feathery, shiny toy, she's happy. She tells me when she wants pets, headbutts, and when she wants to stop. Non-skin-breaking nips. So I believe cats have intentions, consciousness, and moods." And we also have a caller, Joan in San Francisco, with some cat stories. Joan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello. This is really interesting. I had a cat several years ago, and I lived in a two-story house. And one day, I was upstairs. The cat came meowing upstairs at me and wouldn't leave me alone until I followed him downstairs. And when I got downstairs, he had brought in a baby bird that had fallen out of a nest, and it still had its skin where you can see through it. And he looked at the little bird, and he looked up at me and several times as if to ask, "What do we do now, Mom?" And so I picked up the bird and I saved it and all that. But I just thought that was really remarkable. It really seemed to think to me that the cat knew it. It didn't know what to do with it.
Joan, your cats are much more humane than my cats, I'll tell you that.
Well, this particular cat, you know, wasn't a hunter. He was just fascinated with birds. But it just seemed to me that it really demonstrated that here he found this bird outside, obviously, brought it inside into a place where he knew it would be at least a little safer, or be able to be closer to letting me find out, you know, or letting me come up with a solution of what to do with it.
So, John, thanks a lot. Yes. Colin, what do you think? The comparative cognitive achievements of cats versus dogs. Is there any science about this?
Well, there's remarkably little, but I do have a colleague here who is an animal behavior specialist and is always singing the praises of cats. I think the thing is that they're very different from dogs, and if you're not tuned in to cats, it's difficult to read them in any interesting way that makes sense to us who aren't so familiar with cats. I've got two myself, and they would definitely, both of them, have eaten that bird. But we also have to be careful about anthropomorphism here, projecting on on to the animals, things that we think they might be thinking when they're not. So one worry about the cat story and the bird, for instance, is that it may well be that that cat is used to some sort of dominance or hierarchy where it's not supposed to eat something unless it's being given the go-ahead by what it regards as its dominance. Now, you would have to test this in various different ways. I'm not claiming this as a fact. It's just that there's another interpretation of that behavior, which is not the compassionate cat interpretation.
Yeah.
It's the subordinate cat.
Carl, I want to ask you a slightly different question, a kind of methodological question in a way. Look, I think there was a long time when people didn't study this kind of stuff because we were in the darkness of behaviorism and we thought there was no there for any creatures, let alone animals, right? And then cognitive science has happened and we think there are these rich inner processes. But there's a kind of Cartesian thing in me that still remains. And maybe I should exercise it, but I want to know if you can help me. In the following, Descartes said, animals do a lot of really cool things, a lot of really cool things. But what they don't do is use what he called reason as a universal instrument. Now, I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but we could think all kinds of different ways. Now, here's what I'm wondering. I mean, it seems to me that this animal does this cool thing, that animal does that cool thing, and what we really need are some kind of cognitive models, detailed cognitive models of how exactly they're doing that, right? And not just kind of drawing on our intuitions about how it might be done. Do we have such things? Are there people actually trying to build detailed cognitive models of the particular things that animals do and showing that, aha, this is the kind of representation they do. This is the kind of information processing they do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that we do need something along those lines. But I think that cognitive science is at a very interesting juncture where those kinds of Cartesian models themselves, which involve representations and so on, are somewhat under challenge, at least very much around where I sit here in Indiana. I think that part of the move here is to actually understand what we're doing in slightly different terms. And, of course, I've been saying that through the program here. And our own general reasoning may not be as general as we think.
Yeah.
There's some famous psychological results from the Wason card task which show that we don't actually apply this logical reasoning quite as broadly as we'd like to think we do. Even people who are highly schooled in logic. And my radical thought is that that kind of reasoning is in fact something which is an application of the same thing but just to a different set of stimuli,
so
namely
maybe,
symbols on the page.
So
yeah.
Maybe we're getting toward a moment when by understanding animal cognition better and how it relates to our cognition, we understand them both better, right? Maybe
I think that's exactly right. That's always been my goal. And the particular kinds of models then that people are building for specific animals and of course it's very complicated because you've got everything from neuroscience in here to cognitive science, and people look at this at all different kinds of levels of abstraction. You've talked a lot about information processing. That's the way that Irene Pepperberg talked about it in the segment that you did on her. But there are other people who want to talk about it in terms of dynamical systems, in terms of way waves of activity flow around the brain in a continuous fashion and
right.
That relate to behavior.
We'll take this up some more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing animal minds with Colin Allen from Indiana University.
We've been talking about how animals display a variety of cognitive capacities. Coming up, we're going to ask what, if anything, separates animal minds from human minds.
The difference between humans and animals and the difference it makes when Philosophy Talk continues.
Think of all the things we could discuss. If we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could talk to us.
The topic is Animal Minds. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Colin Allen from the Center for Integrative Studies of Animal Behavior at Indiana University. Colin, you guys got to change that name. That's a mouthful. But let's get some more callers in here. Charlotte in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charlotte.
Thank you. I'm one of these people who's often thought that my dog was a heck of a lot smarter than most people I knew. But that aside, I'm interested especially in dogs that are part of rescue teams. They note that when they go through an entire day and they do not find somebody alive, at the end of the day, these dogs are visibly, really visibly depressed. And the handlers have found that at the end of such a day, they create a situation where the dog will find somebody who's alive. They'll just have somebody buried and they'll do it. This indicates something of some understanding of what has gone on during the day. And I mean, I don't know. Can you attribute that to training? What is that?
Well, thanks for the question, Charlotte. Colin, what do you think?
Well, I think this actually fits well with some of the mirror neuron stuff we were talking about before the break, where it looks like a lot of animals have some understanding of the goals of actions and even quite extended actions. And so if the dog understands that the goal is to find somebody and that goal is not satisfied, then you would expect certain kinds of consequences of that. Of course, a dog that hasn't had the training is not going to have the expectations in that situation. That's the extent to which the training and experience is important here. But generally, I think a basic capacity for goal understanding is within reach of many animals.
Colin, we want to segue a little bit into ethical issues that arise from thinking about animal consciousness. And I've got kind of an intriguing email I'm going to read here. Most people believe that our moral and ethical obligations to animals depend on the possession of some kind of mental life by the animal. This is from Paul in San Francisco. But if an animal can feel pain, then we have a moral obligation not to inflict it. But the South Korean government recently issued a robot ethics charter granting certain rights and obligations to robots. I guess they call those the robot's rules of order. Ha ha. And nobody thinks a robot can experience pain. Can your guest shed some light on this apparent disparity between our ethical attitudes towards robots who have no mind, animals that who do, and humans who probably do?
That's a mouthful, Colin. What do you think?
Yeah, a big topic there. Actually, robot consciousness is something I am very interested in, and it's true that none of the robots we have presently are anywhere approaching that, but I don't see that as an impossibility. I think the Koreans are probably a little ahead of the curve here in trying to write rules for this. But it is interesting the extent to which our legislature is very confused when it comes to animals. So, for instance, in the U.S., the Animal Welfare Act specifically includes protections only for mammals and birds, and it even excludes rats and for vertebrates, it excludes birds and rats from that protection. And the British equivalent, the Animal Scientific Protection Act, protects all vertebrates and the common octopus. One species of octopus.
So let me ask you a question. Okay, let's probe this a little more deeply, because some people think that animals are moral patients. I mean, we can do harm to them. We can wrong them, morally wrong them. I don't think anybody thinks that animals are moral agents. They can't really do harm to us, or moral harm to us. Now, certainly not all animals are moral patients. I mean, maybe they all are. Where does it begin that we begin to owe animals something?
Yes, so here we get back. Yeah, here we get back to the details sorts of questions, right? So a lot of people want to draw a hard and fast distinction between vertebrates and invertebrates, but as we've seen, the British are confused about that, and with good reason, I think. There are lots of invertebrates that do lots of really complex, sophisticated things. What do we owe animals? Well, what we owe presumably varies depending on what that animal is capable of. So this work that Nikki Clayton was doing that was reported in Nature last week about scrub jays being able to plan for the future. This is a fascinating experiment. Makes us think that they have more anticipation of future outcomes than we previously thought. So maybe now we have to take that into account when we think about how to treat them. But other animals maybe are much more in the present, much more in the moment, and you know, a painless death at the end of a happy life is not such a bad thing.
Lots of animals feel pain. Do we owe them something in virtue of the seem to feel pain? Certainly a lot of animals writhe about when you do bad things to them and engage in avoidance behavior. Do we owe anything to them just in virtue of the fact that they feel pain? And if that's enough, I mean, do we owe them something different in virtue of the fact that they are capable of feeling pain than we owe humans in virtue of the fact? I mean, should animal pain and human pain count equally?
Well, that's a question for the ethicists, and I always think those questions are too hard for me to answer. I guess my view on this is that there's much more to what our ethical obligations are than simply feeling pain. So that's one determinant, but it's not the only determinant.
Yeah, I agree there's a lot more, but I don't think feeling pain ought to be missed. I'm one who believes that animals do feel pain and that it's ethically important. But still, there is a big difference between human pain. I mean, when I feel pain, it's not just the pain. I'm full of thoughts and anticipations and worries. I mean, this backache probably means my spine is ready to completely collapse, and I'll be dead within a month or turn into a vegetable. And moreover, it's all my fault for not sitting up straight when I was in school. So human pain is a somewhat richer thing, but maybe the scrub jays, you know, they're not only going to feel the pain, they're going to say, oh, all those grubs I've got in those trees, and I'm not going to get to them. So it's interesting.
Yeah, frustration could be there.
Right.
But yeah, I think the interesting thing about pain, again, some scientific work here, shows that actually humans under certain circumstances will prefer more pain rather than less pain. And this is equally true of animals. It's equally true of rats, for instance. So the circumstances, if you're given a fairly intense pain and it ends abruptly, or the choice of intense pain which tails off, could end at that same point but tails off, you'll take the more extended tailing off pain than the abruptly ending intense pain. So you actually prefer more pain to less pain.
Colin, I've got a sort of last thought because we're getting down to the bottom, but it sounds like, okay, animals come in a wide variety. Their minds, there's probably a great chain of animal minds from, you know, the lowest worms.
Yeah,
to
don't
to
say
the
chain. It's not, no, that's the wrong picture.
The great
Ken,
tree.
Yeah, it's a very bushy tree.
Yeah,
yes.
The great bushy tree. And maybe what we owe them depends on where they are on that bushy tree. But now I'm thinking human beings kind of are on a bushy tree with respect to their capacities too. So maybe, you know, could it be that some humans and some animals are in the same place on the bushy
tree? Are you leading up to a joke about where we put bush on the tree?
No, I'm just wondering, does this conflict, once we start saying these capacities come in a bushy tree, and once we start looking at ourselves again, should that complicate our look at ourselves again?
Well, sure. I mean, I think there's a whole tradition in ethics here, which is something like moral particularism or something, right? Where there are no general principles in the end, that one has to take all of these details into account.
Yeah. So on that note, and last comment. Make your last comment.
Well, I was just going to say, and the question of whether any humans are in the same place as any animals, I want to get beyond that kind of straight one-to-one comparison. I think that we're all in different places and they're all interesting places.
On that note, Colin, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Colin Allen. He's professor of history and philosophy of science at the Center for the Study of Animal Behavior at Indiana University, co-editor of The Cognitive Animal and also Philosophy Across the Life Sciences.
And we also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to and the emails we didn't get a chance to read.
Yeah, we had a whole slew of callers and emails, but, you know, we can only take so many. But we're really grateful to you anyway. So, John, what did we learn today?
Well, there are these people like Colin Allen that managed to know so much and get so much done, you know, in addition to his philosophy and all he knows about psychology and so forth. He's also one of the big presences on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, for which we all owe him a lot. I want to mention a couple of books that have been suggested. One of our emailers, Catherine in Oakland, suggested Dogs That Know When Their Masters Are Coming Home by Rupert Sheldrick. So you might be interested in that. On the general issue, Minds of Their Own, Thinking About Awareness in Animals by Leslie J. Rogers. Minding Animals, edited by Jane Goodall and Mark Beckoff. And our own Colin Allen and Mark Beckoff have Species of Mind, The Philosophy and Biology of Cognitive Ethology, and on the ethics, the classic is Animal Liberation by Peter Singer.
And there's this lovely book that I'm intrigued by, When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lies of Animals. I want to learn about that. But, you know, I this is a fascinating topic, and the thing that strikes me, which I actually hadn't really thought that hard about before, is the potential not only of this kind of research to change our understanding of animals, but to change our understanding of ourselves as we understand how we're related and different and similar to animals. You know?
So finally, I'm going to be able to understand what you mean when you kind of stick your nose under my arm and do a lot
yeah,
of barking.
Right.
I mean, that'll be very helpful in our interactions, I think.
This conversation continues in a higher tone than that on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. Neither of us has weighed in yet, but I will weigh in. I have lots of thoughts about this.
You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well, and soon from iAmplify.
John, it's my favorite time of the show.
What time is that, Ken?
Those drummings give it away. Conundrum time. And we've got a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hey, well, thanks.
Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Steve, and I'm calling from Seattle.
Oh, Seattle.
How do you hear us up there in Seattle?
Well, I listen to you guys while I'm at work. Over the internet.
Ah. And what do you do up there in Seattle when you're pretending to work and instead listening to Philosophy Talk?
I am an architect.
Oh, some of my favorite people are architects.
We should explain to people that unlike watching YouTube, you can listen to Philosophy Talk while your computer screen has some Excel spreadsheet on it that looks perfectly respectable.
Yeah. So anyway, Steve, tell us about your conundrum.
Well, I kind of moved into my conundrum, literally. I actually have a living situation where I share a two-bedroom apartment with a roommate. And he was recommended to me by a friend, and he was recommended to me as a safe person to live with because he's actually engaged and getting married. So he sounds pretty responsible. Well, over the last 6 to 7 months, I've basically come to figure out that he's cheating on his fiancée, and I'm now put in a moral obligation to my friends whether or not I should tell on him.
Did you learn about this that in any way involved confidential transmission from your roommate?
Kind of an accidentally walking into something.
Uh-huh. Could what you have walked into be interpreted differently? I mean, are you pretty clear that this is really an ongoing character flaw-revealing relationship?
Basically, I can pretty much verify that it's a weekly event now.
Wow. So this guy doesn't really want to be married, as I assume.
Correct.
Is your roommate your friend? Do you feel any obligation of loyalty to protect his secrets?
Not really. Since he was recommended, he's kind of a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. And actually, the truth of it is that my friends are really good friends with his fiance. So I almost have a higher obligation to his fiance.
Okay, so I kind of saw what the obligations to the fiance might be. I was trying to figure out what's on the other side. So it sounds like what's on the other side, the impetus not to tell, I hate to put too fine a point on it, is naked self-interest. Is that right? Because that if you told, you'd lose a roommate and you'd have to pay for the whole expensive apartment or condo or wherever you live in Seattle. Is that right?
Correct.
If you had a particular loyalty to the fiance, I would say, God, out of deep loyalty to this woman, you should tell her that she's about to marry a schmuck. And forget your naked self-interest, because loyalty is more morally relevant, and naked self-interest is, you know, sometimes permissible, but not always.
Look, it sounds like you have what we might call back channels to the fiancé.
Correct.
So that you could get a word to her to kind of investigate it on her own and make her own discovery without having it credited to you. Now, that might be a little bit manipulative and sleazy, but in a situation where you're dealing with a dishonest person, I don't see too much moral problem with that. Ken's a little bit more moral than I am. Maybe he does.
Well, a lot more, John. No, I'm just teasing. My thought is there aren't any sort of concrete loyalties that are driving this issue. Loyalty to the fiancé versus loyalty to the friend. Stuff learned in confidence versus stuff just you discovered. I mean, if the guy trusts you with his secret and you agreed to be trusted, then, and it's really, you're just thinking naked self-interest. I mean, you feel a little kind of moral pang in not telling, it sounds like, but is there really any deep moral pang in not telling?
No, that's a little unfair. He felt enough of a moral pang to call two loquacious philosophers, probably long distance. I mean, suppose worst comes to worst, they get married, the affair continues, it all blows up. Do you think your friends that are her friends would have a right to resent you for not having told them?
Possibly, yeah.
I give you a decision procedure. First you say, well, whatever I do shouldn't be for selfish reasons, so I'll put this consideration of the rent out of sight. Now the question is, what's the principle? Principle A, none of my business. Principle B, the best thing for the innocent person would be for me to tell. Now you weigh those two things. Now, then, you know, how do you do it? Well, you could read a couple thousand pages of philosophy, but I would say just think hard about the conversation you'll have with the friend, the mutual friend between you and the fiance later, and think about how it would go and how you would feel. And I think if you do that, you'll figure out what to do.
Think about your soul, Steve. You're not thinking enough about your soul. You know, you're thinking about your, as it were, bodily self-interest, you know, but you're not thinking about the state of your soul, as Plato would say. So there's a lot that you have to figure out. And I know we haven't figured it out for you, but you know what? That's about the best we're going to do.
Enjoy the weather.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at nights, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.